As has been announced, this morning I'd like to address the topic of the hyperboles of Jesus. Hyperbole might not be a term you're familiar with. Sounds like a big word, doesn't it? But I'm sure you use hyperboles all the time in your speech. Let me start off by observing that though good Christians, some people might think of them as, they call them fundamentalists, though I do not accept that term for myself. But anyway, people think of good Christians as those who take the Bible literally. But I have to say that even though I take the parts of the Bible literally that are supposed to be taken literally, we should recognize that the Bible contains a great deal of figurative language, figures of speech, which is not to be taken literally. People think that when we take the Bible literally, or what they mean when we take the Bible literally, is that we take it as history. For instance, people who do not take the Bible literally would say that some of the stories in the book of Genesis, like the story of the creation of Adam and Eve or the creation of the world in 6 days, that's not really historical. And they say it's not to be taken literally. And so they say those are just stories that are kind of like fairy tales or fables that illustrate certain truths, but they themselves did not really happen. So I take the Bible literally in the sense that I take it as a narrative of history, of what actually occurred. That's true. But at the same time, we need to recognize that there is a great deal of figurative language or figures of speech in the Bible. What do we mean by figurative language or figures of speech? Well, to assign a literal meaning to words is to take them in their basic or common or primary sense, while a figurative meaning of a word is to take it in an acquired secondary sense. And in other words, the literal meaning of a word develops first, and then it might be given a figurative application. And this is really pretty simple. For instance, when you hear the word fox, what does that mean? Well, probably means something like a little red, furry, dog-like animal. Okay? That's its literal meaning. But then you can give a second meaning to the word fox. Fox is a little red, furry, dog-like animal. It's what you would think of. That's the common first meaning that we would think of, anybody would think of when we hear in English the word fox. But then in Luke 13, verse 32, Jesus called Herod the Tetrarch a fox. We can't give it the literal meaning. I mean, do we really think that the ruler Herod was a little red, furry, dog-like animal? No. So it has to have a second meaning there. It means that Herod, the Tetrarch, and a fox shared something in common. It craftiness or slyness, I would think. Okay? So that's what Jesus means. So he's using the word fox in that secondary figurative sense. Now, despite all of this, what I've just said, people still fail to appreciate the Bible's use of figurative language. That's, to really understand figures of speech in the Bible is to go a long way in toward understanding the Bible's message. But because people do not appreciate the use of figurative language in the Scriptures, they misunderstand the Bible in some instances. For instance, Revelation 7 verse 4 refers to 144,000 in heaven, or in this scene anyway that John sees, and the Jehovah's Witnesses take that number literally and think there are only 144,000 people will go to heaven. The rest will stay here upon this earth, or the saved will stay up, the rest of the saved will stay upon the earth. So they miss the qualitative idea that that number 144,000 has. It's a figure of speech. Indeed, the most basic way that we're able to distinguish between literal speech and figurative speech is that figurative speech is not literally possible. And we'll see instances of that as we look at some hyperboles of Jesus. They all use the word, so let's go ahead and define the word hyperbole. It is a figure of speech. It is not to be taken literally then. Okay? The dictionary says that a hyperbole is a figure of speech in which exaggeration is used for emphasis or effect. In other words, you want to emphasize or stress a certain truth, so you kind of blow it up, you expand it, at least in the way that you express it. But it is the element or kernel of truth there at the center of the expression that Jesus wanted people to grasp. Now, again, once we learn this about hyperbole, it's not expressing the whole truth literally, but there's a kernel of truth that we need to be impressed with at the center of it, then that's going to go a long way toward relieving some of the misunderstanding associated with this figure of speech in particular. Now, you may not have heard the word hyperbole before, but they're so common that I imagine any one of you use them like a million times a day. There I go. I've used a hyperbole. You don't literally use the hyperboles a million times a day. At the expense of the women getting mad at me, if you're a husband, you're very familiar with the use of hyperbole. Okay? If you don't understand what I just said, perhaps it's better that you didn't. But anyway, so yes, I'm making a little bit of a joke here. But yes, if you're a husband, as Jerry and I were talking about this before, wives tend to be given to the use of hyperbole. Husbands, have you ever heard this expression? We don't spend any time together. We don't do anything together. And you might say, well, yeah, we did this together just last week. So, but of course, wives in that instance are using an exaggeration to make a point. They're not trying to lie and be literal. They just, you know, they feel strongly about, spending some time with their husbands, and therefore, you know, they'll stress that fact by saying, we don't do anything together. Which is not literally true, of course, but they're using hyperbole. Okay? Alright, so let's look at some examples of Jesus' hyperbole. Or hyperboles, plural. Okay? And I want to start off using some that are obvious. And then look at some instances that people don't think are obvious. They tend to take them literally, in other words. Okay. Alright, in Luke the 19th chapter, verses 37 through 40, we have an instance of Jesus using hyperbole there. Let me just read this passage here. Luke 19, verses 37 through 40. And as he was now approaching near the descent of the Mount of Olives, the whole multitude of the disciples began to praise God joyfully with a loud voice for all the miracles which they had seen, saying, Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord, peace in heaven and glory in the highest. And some of the Pharisees in the multitude said to him, Teacher, rebuke your disciples. And he answered and said, I tell you, if these become silent, the stones will cry out. Well, of course, stones, being inanimate objects, cannot cry out. So Jesus was using a hyperbole here. He wasn't being literal. Jesus pointed out, in response to the Pharisees' objection to the multitude's acclamations of him, that the truth which they shouted about him was so true and so urgently needed to be expressed that it would seem that if Jesus or anyone tried to suppress their crying out this truth, then it would have to come out someplace else. It's kind of like if you sit on a bag with water in it. If you sit on it, okay, it's going to come out in one place. And if you put your finger there, it's going to come out another hole. Okay, it's got to come out. It's like lava from a volcano under pressure. That pressure's got to be released. It would seem that the very rocks or stones would cry out with these truths. Jesus wasn't speaking literally. He was using hyperbole when he said, the stones will cry out. He meant to say, this is truth that has to come out. Somebody has to say it. Let's go to another example. In Matthew 23, verse 24, Jesus said to the Pharisees, you hypocrites who strain out a gnat but swallow a camel. When I was very young and living with my family in Mississippi, we had a cow, and my brothers would go out and milk the cow in the morning and bring back the milk of the cow in the pail to my mother, and she would put a cheesecloth over it and would strain it, pour it through the cheesecloth. That way, if any impurities got in there, at least the larger impurities could be removed. And the Jews apparently had to do the same thing with their milk. They might put some cloth over the container of milk in order to get if some sort of gnat or small bug got into it. You know, they would strain out that gnat. And Jesus said, you know, you Pharisees, you hypocrites. You are careful to make sure you get the gnats out of your lives, but you're swallowing camels. Now, that's hyperbole, of course. A camel cannot be swallowed, can it? At least not all at one time. Which is the idea. In my lifetime, I might have swallowed a cow, but it's been small pieces at a time, you know? Over a long period of time. But you see here, Jesus was merely using the camel as a symbol of the Pharisees' hypocrisy. To satisfy themselves that they were righteous, they were meticulous, to perform these small obligations or to get rid of the small, you might say, sins in their lives, these gnats, what might be called a gnat. But there were some things, on the other hand, that they didn't want to do. And so they overlooked the major obligations that they had. So it was as though they swallowed a camel. Jesus is using hyperbole here to make a point. You're a hypocrite. You're concerned about these relatively small things, but you can say by being concerned about these small things, look at me, I'm righteous, but you overlook much bigger problems or sins in your life, the camels in your life. You really take those in. Let's go to another example. Forgiving 70 times 7 is what Jesus said in Matthew the 18th chapter, verses 21 and 22. There he said, or there it says, then Peter came and said to him, Lord, how often shall my brother sin against me and I forgive him? Up to 7 times? Jesus said to him, I do not say to you up to 7 times, but up to 70 times 7, which, I'm not a mathematician, not very good at math, but it's 490, I believe. Of course, Jesus did not mean that some sort of record of offenses committed and forgiveness extended was to be kept. He didn't say, you know, you need to have a record book of all these offenses, and when you get to 491, say, no more, not forgiving you again. That's virtually impossible. Who's going to even keep track, even mentally, of how many times someone has sinned? 7 times, even that many. Rather, he was emphatically saying that a count of offenses, such as Peter suggested, indicated a begrudging unwillingness to forgive. And that's contrary to the spirit of forgiveness. You don't forgive begrudgingly. Forgiveness is about trying to forget others' offenses, not keeping track of them at all. The Lord said in Jeremiah 31, verse 34, that those under the new covenant would have their transgressions not remembered. Their transgressions I will remember. I will remember no more, he said. I won't even remember them. So when Jesus said, forgive 70 times 7, he was talking about this willingness to forgive. Not doing it begrudgingly. And if you're keeping track of someone's sins against you, that does not express a willingness to forgive. Now, there are some other difficulties I will grant that I have with this passage right now. Jerry and I were discussing this passage just the other day over the phone because I'm having some difficulty with some aspects of it. I don't misunderstand the basic point that Jesus is trying to make. But tell you what, I hope that pretty soon I can present a lesson, a sermon just on this passage to deal with it more fully. But for right now, we understand that Jesus is using hyperbole here. When he says, forgive 70 times 7, representing our willingness to forgive. Another example, in Matthew 17, verse 20, Jesus said, because of the littleness of your faith. Now, he's explaining why they were not able to cast out a demon from a man's son. But he goes on to say, for truly I say to you, if you have faith as a mustard seed, you shall say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it shall move, and nothing shall be impossible for you. Wow. Now, a mustard seed was among the smallest, or was the smallest of the herbs. Very small, or smallest of the trees, or seeds of trees, or bushes, whatever. Very small. He said, If you have faith just as little as that, you can move mountains. And he actually went on beyond that and said, and said, nothing shall be impossible to you. Now, sometimes, you know, that makes me feel kind of bad because I've never done anything like moving a mountain. Never even come close to it. I tell you, I've never even moved so much as a pebble from one place to another. So, have you? No. Jesus is not being literal here. As a matter of fact, there are no instances of mountain moving, literally speaking, in the New Testament. Okay? So, Jesus is simply trying, by this hyperbole, to make a statement about the power of faith. If your faith is what it ought to be, you can do great things. Maybe not great by the standard of the world, but you can do great things. Let's move on to another example. There are a lot of hyperboles in the Sermon on the Mount. As a matter of fact, we need to appreciate that in order to understand really what Jesus is saying in the Sermon on the Mount. He uses a cluster of hyperboles there. And here's one that we can readily understand. Now, so far, I think we can easily see that Jesus' statements are not to be taken literally, okay? They're hyperboles, exaggerations for effect, okay? This is one that's pretty obvious. Okay, Jesus said, if your right eye causes you to stumble, tear it out. If your right hand causes you to stumble, that is to sin, and your soul will be threatened, cut off your right hand. Now, almost nobody takes this literally. I think I heard one time about a man cutting off his right hand or his hand in order to obey Jesus' statement here. Maybe he was insane, he was crazy, I don't know. I heard that maybe one of the ancient, sometimes people apply the term or phrase church fathers to them, Origen, I think it might have been, he actually emasculated himself, let me put it that way, in order to deal with his, I guess he was following through on what Jesus effectively said, deal with sexual temptation. But is that what Jesus is really saying here? If you're having a problem with the, if you have a tendency to look at bad things, then pull out your eyes, or if you do wrong things, then cut off your hands, go to wrong places, cut off your feet, you know. Or emasculate yourself if you're a man and you're having a problem with sexual temptation. No, that's not what he's saying. For instance, there is no New Testament example of Christians ever mutilating their bodies in an effort to try to remain faithful to Christ. For one thing, it's the mind, really, that tells the members of the body what to do. So if you cut off a hand, well, then you still got the other hand to sin with, and you're still going to be able to sin up here in your mind. So just cutting off a part of the body is really not going to be effective in helping you in that way. And furthermore, if you start mutilating your body physically, you're going to deprive yourself of that ability to serve Christ effectively. I mean, I'm not going to be able to serve Christ effectively and teach others as effectively if I start cutting off my hands and I start plucking out my eyes, that sort of thing. So this is not workable. What we're really told to do is to renew our minds. Renew our minds in Romans 12, verse 2. So what is Jesus saying then when he says, if your right hand causes you to stumble, cut it off, same with your right eye? Well, the right eye and hand were symbols of anything precious. For instance, if people say, if you had to lose one of your senses, which is the one you would at least be willing to part with? In most instances, it seems like people talk about their sense of sight, their eyes, losing their sight. I mean, it would be hard to lose any. If I lost my sense of taste, I would lose the pleasure of eating, but at least I might be able to survive, you know, if I couldn't taste or smell. But, of course, blind people can survive too, but there is so much information that we take in through our eyes as opposed to our sense of taste or sense of smell that, you know, people, I guess, would least like to lose their eyes. So the eyesight is very precious to us. Same with the right hand. I mean, there's so much we do with our hands. So, but see, the right eye and the right hand are just symbols for anything that we consider very precious or valuable to us in our lives. And what Jesus is saying here is, listen, however precious or valuable something in your life might be to you, Nothing is worth the loss of your soul. So get rid of it. So here's the point. For instance, to be practical, if maybe watching television causes you to sin, you see things you shouldn't see, and that leads to other sins, your television may be very important to you, but get rid of it in order to save your soul, because your soul is so much more valuable. And it can apply to anything material in our lives. If your job brings you an income that allows you to buy pleasures in your life, but it's the kind of job that is threatening your soul, give up the money and give up what it can buy. Be willing to submit to a lower standard of living in order to save your soul in heaven, if that's what it takes. That's the point Jesus is making here. He's not literally saying that we need to pluck out our eyes or cut off our hands. He's using hyperbole to make a point that we need to give priority to our souls, even to the extent of being willing, if necessary, to get rid of anything valuable or precious in our lives that might threaten the well-being of our souls. Okay, then, here we start on this point now. So far, I think we've understood everything, right? It's been pretty easy to understand these hyperboles, that they're exaggerations to make a point. And we need to see that inner kernel of truth. Okay, we don't take them, the whole hyperbole, literally. Okay? Despite all of that, some people, when they come to some hyperboles, then they start to want to take them literally. And here's an example of that. Okay, so here's basically what I've been building toward. Turning the other cheek. Now, Ezekiel's already read this passage, so I won't read it again. And it's one I'm sure that you're familiar with if you've known the New Testament for a long time. And Jesus said, turn the other cheek. some people want to come pretty close to saying we ought to take that literally. And they want to say, you know, individuals and governments cannot do anything to protect and defend themselves. Because Jesus said, do not resist evil. Do not resist it, but turn the other cheek. If someone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. Now really, are we supposed to take that literally? I mean, what if someone did strike you on one cheek and you turn to him the other? What are you telling him? Okay, you sinned by hitting me on one cheek. Now sin again. I'll give you the other cheek. If we take that literally, we're inviting a person to compound his sin. No. Jesus was using hyperbole here, as in all the other instances I have mentioned. And when Jesus says, give to him who wishes to borrow from you, and do not turn away. Well, listen, if you take that literally and word gets out of your community, you're going to have everybody and his neighbor or his brother on your doorstep wanting to borrow money from you. And you're going to be impoverished. That's the way it's going to be. So really, don't take that literally. Oh, Jesus, all Jesus was simply saying there is be compassionate, be generous. But he used hyperbole to express that point very emphatically. And we could go on. But Jesus did not expect his disciples to impoverish and to enslave themselves. Remember when he said, if someone wants you to go 1 mile, go with him 2? Really? If someone stops you on the street and says, take me 1 mile up the road, I'll take you wherever you want to go. Is that really what he means? No, he's not telling his disciples to say, let people take advantage of you. Let them enslave you. Let them take all that you have. Really? What Jesus is saying in this paragraph, in this hyperbolic, emphatic way, is that lex talionis, now that's the Latin, it means the law of retaliation, did not justify personal vengeance in your interactions with people. In other words, if someone does something bad to you, okay, figuratively speaking, slaps you on the cheek. Now, the natural reaction for a Christian is to punch back or to slap back. Don't do that necessarily, Jesus is saying. Okay? Don't retaliate. Don't look and wait for an opportunity to get back at him, to get even with him. We're not about vengeance as disciples of Christ. That is not to say, though, that there is no recourse for us. If we are assaulted, we can call the police. As a matter of fact, Paul essentially did that in Acts the 23rd chapter when there was a plot against his life. He informed the Roman commander. So, Jesus is not forbidding individuals or governments to protect and defend themselves when he says, turn the other cheek. He's basically saying, don't seek personal vengeance. He's not saying that you cannot protect yourself or that you cannot seek relief from the police or from the courts. He was using hyperbole to stress the need to be compassionate, to be generous when he said to give. He was not saying we should be stupid. It is not really being compassionate, for one thing, to a person or it's not really helping him if we allow him to abuse us and to rob us and to cheat us. How does that help him? As a matter of fact, Paul said in 2 Thessalonians 3, verse 10, if a man will not work, neither let him eat. There Paul says, actually, don't let him eat. Don't give him food. We have to reconcile that with what Jesus said. And we do that by recognizing Jesus was using hyperbole to say, don't seek vengeance. Okay? here again, we can see this point in other hyperboles used in the Sermon on the Mount. In the 6th chapter of Matthew, Jesus was talking about those who would practice their righteousness to be noticed by people in order to get praised by them. So with respect to alms, he said, and this here's an example of hyperbole in the Sermon on the Mount. That's very obvious. He said, when you give, do not let your right hand, let me just read it, verse 3. But when you give alms, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. Have you ever been able to do that? Anything like that? You ever been able to do something with your right hand and your left hand was unaware of it? Hyperbole, folks. Jesus is simply saying, listen. He's not saying that nobody else can ever know when you give money to help somebody else. But when you do it, don't make a display out of it for the purpose of impressing others. He made that point by using hyperbole. But he does the same thing when it comes to prayer. In verse 6, he says, but you, when you pray, go into your inner room and pray in secret. Wait, now is he saying that every time we pray, we can only do so in the inner room of our house when we're all by ourselves? No. He's not forbidding public prayer. That's his emphatic way of saying, using hyperbole, when you pray, don't try to show off. Okay? Don't do it for the purpose of saying, of getting someone to say, look at me, or look at him. He's righteous because look how long he's praying. Okay? And then the example of fasting. Even in the matter of fasting, Jesus said, but you, when you fast, anoint your head and put on a garment, or in other words, don't make it look like you're fasting. It's, again, the same point. He's not saying that you have to anoint your head or you have to put on a clean suit of clothes or whatever when you fast, but just don't make it obvious that you're fasting by looking bedraggled. Okay? And I'm sorry. So I didn't advance that for the benefit of others. Jesus was stressing that the giver is not to put his giving on display to impress others, to pray publicly, or to fast to impress others. But he expressed that truth by hyperbole. Another example. Again, in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 7, verses 3 through 5, Jesus said, first take the log out of your own eye, log or beam out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye. Well, the speck or the mote, as the King James Version calls it, and the log or the beam, as the King James Version calls it, are comparable to the gnat and the camel that we were talking about in Matthew 23:24. They represent relatively small and large sins, respectively. Okay, and Jesus is saying simply, listen, don't be so concerned about criticizing the speck in your the small sin in your brother's life. When you've got this big long beam, which it's impossible to have a beam in your eye, when you've got this beam or this log in your own eye, that's hyperbole. He was saying, listen, first deal with the big problems that you've got. And then he said, then if you do that, then you'll be in a position to help someone who has a speck in his eye. And going through the eye of the needle, here's another one that people want to try to give some literal statement to. Now, some people think that the eye of the needle to which Jesus was referring was a small gate beside a large city gate. At night, the large city gates were closed. People couldn't get, they couldn't be opened again. So if someone came late, maybe with a merchant with a loaded down camel, the camel could get through the smaller gate, which could be opened. Okay? But first the camel would have to be unloaded and might have to crawl through the gate on his knees or whatever, and then all the merchandise would have to be moved through the gate, small gate, or the eye of the needle, as it was sometimes called, supposedly. And then it could be reloaded. Well, that's a difficult process. Who wants to do that? Make sure you get to the city gates before they're closed. Okay? Here's the problem, though. Even if these small gates were called the eyes of needles, and even if they were open like that to allow latecomers to come in, I'm not sure that Jesus would meant to refer to that. It's probably more likely that he was using hyperbole to stress the impediment which a man's wealth could create for his efforts to get to heaven. Okay? So he said it's harder for a rich man to get into the kingdom of heaven than for a camel to get through the eye of a needle. He was expressing the great difficulty of that. And so he used hyperbole. One last example that also, because they don't appreciate hyperbole, people may take offense at. Jesus said in Luke the 14th chapter, verse 26, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple." Now, really? Oh, hate? Hate your family members in order to be a disciple of Christ? Hate them? It's pretty strong language. Jesus is using hyperbole there. And when we understand that, that takes care of the problem. Really. Jesus is not being literal here. Jesus was obviously using hyperbole when he told his disciples that they would have to hate their family members to be his disciples. Why, how do we know that? Because the scriptures elsewhere, such as in Ephesians 5:25, husbands love your wives, Titus 2 verse 4, wives love your husbands, and so on. These passages call upon God's people to love their family members. So is there a contradiction in Scripture? No, if we understand that Jesus was using hyperbole. Because hate can mean to love less. In Genesis 29, verses 30 and 31 is an example of that. It says that Jacob loved Rachel more than Leah. The next verse says, when God saw that Leah was hated. Well, she wasn't hated literally. If you go back to the preceding verse, you see that what hated means, and as it's defined there, is loved less. So when we understand that, we understand that hate sometimes is a hyperbole for loving someone less than someone else. So then when we come to Luke 14:26 and we understand the hyperbole of hate there, we understand that Jesus anticipated that family members then, as is true today, could be an obstacle to faithful service to Christ. So becoming his disciple meant loving him so much that any love for one's family members would seem like hatred of them by comparison with their love for him. Even so, hate there is hyperbole. It's a strong expression meant to set forth a central truth that we are to love Jesus that much more than our family members. In conclusion then, when we as Bible students learn what hyperbole is, and really, I think we knew what hyperbole was, even if we didn't know it by that name, we knew what it was because we use these exaggerations, don't we, all the time. Like, that fog is so thick. We did have fog this morning. Somebody said, that fog is so thick you could cut it with a knife. Hyperbole there. When we learn hyperbole and how often Jesus and others in the Scriptures used it, then I think we can become more skillful in identifying it and understanding what the central message is there, instead of, as some people, they get tripped up and they think, oh, some of these hyperboles, they think they have to take them somehow more or less literally or find some sort of literal explanation for them. No, that's not the case. If we don't understand the hyperboles, and what the central message in them is, then we're going to make an awful mess out of our interpretations of the Bible. It may be that there's at least one here today who, as I said just a moment ago, has not really loved Jesus so much heretofore that he has been willing to overcome any love for the things of this world or the people of this world. If you're here and you understand now that that's a foolish decision, that you need to give priority to Jesus, you need to love him more, and you need to express that love by obedience to Christ, even by being baptized into him upon a confession of your faith and repentance, we bid you to come forward in just a moment and do that. If you're here and you have done that, but since then have not lived so as to give Jesus that priority in your life, and you want to come forward and ask for our help, confess your sins, and seek renewal with God and with His people, once again, we bid you to come forward. Let your needs be known, as for your encouragement, we now stand and sing.